Chapter 26. High Altitude Dancing. As the first term of my third year art studies at East Sydney Technical College drew to a close, the prospect of returning to New Guinea to visit my mother filled me with great excitement. I put my Sydney life on hold once again and flew out to Port Moresby, then on to Goroka, for 2 and a bit weeks, in the land that time forgot, to quote author Edgar Rice Burroughs. This quote reflected the perception many held that New Guinea was a prehistoric world, a land of fiery volcanoes, earth tremors and headhunters. The only thing missing were the dinosaurs. But to get serious, I arrived in Goroka just in time to help put the finishing touches to my mother's wool project display for the 1968 Goroka show. We were now old hands at this show business caper, following the wool project's first, and hugely successful, appearance at the Mount Hagen show in 1965. Since then, the Mount Hagen and Goroka show committees had decided that instead of competing for the tourist dollar, they'd take turns to host their shows, year in year about. Mount Hagen taking the odd years, and Goroka the evens. After the wool project had taken the Hagen show by storm, the thrill had gone out of it for us. Now, it was all a bit ho-hum, although the weavers still got a kick out of dressing up in traditional tribal costume, to demonstrate their weaving skills for all to see, and for tourists to photograph. In 4 years, the wool project had become a Department of Trade and Industry success story. Handpicked groups of local tribesmen had been taught to spin and weave, and with design guidance, produced very saleable items. The income from which, in time, would be taxable. The wool project was now well established at the Goroka showground, since the unusual uplift out of Kundiawa by Caribou aircraft, back in early 1967. The looms, spinning wheels and yarns, were now housed in a very large circular hut, made of bush materials, with a thatched roof. The final touch was a recently added, snazzy, hand-painted wool project sign hanging above the door. As a result, setting up for the thousands of people who were expected to make their way to Goroka for the spectacle of a lifetime was a cinch, because we didn't have to travel. The spinners and weavers had been busy, as evidenced by the piles of stock in the storeroom. Raw fleece and hand-spun cream wool and floor rugs were in high demand, as were single-bed-sized woolen blankets and ponchos, designed by my mother, who made the most of the mill-spun woolen yarns, often millens, that arrived regularly from Australia, thanks to her contacts in textile manufacturing. Each item had been scoured, pressed, folded and individually packed into a clear plastic bag, with the wording, "Hand-woven in New Guinea," printed on both sides in big, bold, black capital letters. We were now ready for the buyer tsunami we were expecting, because the wool project had quickly developed a reputation for stylish quality products. Because of this, the shows were always a sellout, with additional orders taken, guaranteeing work for the weavers, long after the show weekend was over. On Saturday morning, day one of the Goroka show, the floodgates opened, and in rushed 50,000 warriors wearing full traditional dress, and 2,000 tourists, including film crews and journalists, who'd arrived from all over New Guinea and beyond, on all kinds of chartered aircraft. The show's official opening provided a platform for the colonial overlords to bestow a modicum of pomp and ceremony on the formalities. This was in sharp contrast to the Highlanders watching the proceedings, who'd been practicing their ritual ceremonies for thousands of years. The official opening speech was always delivered by an important European, in English, a language unintelligible to the majority of the crowd. The tribal dancers waited patiently for the formalities to conclude, so they could dance for the judges, each group keen to strut their stuff and win first prize. On Saturday night there was the much-anticipated show ball. The ball was an excuse for expatriates to dress up and have a good time, doing their own style of dancing with a partner, if they had one. Otherwise, it was an opportunity to drink, and drink some more, in true territorian style. There was always live music at the show ball, provided by a band brought in for the evening, either from a larger center or from Australia. Sunday was recovery day. Most Europeans were hungover, so things moved slowly. By afternoon, it was time to break camp at the showground, with the patrol officers, known as Kiaps, preparing to take their people back to their villages. For the wool project, it was easy. At closing time, we simply locked the door of the house blanket and headed home exhausted, and glad it was all over. Some days later, Jim Lay, patriarch of the post-war Lay and Collins Highland clan, approached my mother. Jim owned and ran Erindale, a successful coffee plantation and mixed farm on the Highlands Highway, not far west of Goroka. As part of his livestock mix, he had a small flock of Romney Marsh sheep that needed shearing. He asked if the wool project would be interested in the fleece. After inspecting the sheep, my mother agreed to take it, once the sheep had been shorn. The tricky bit would be finding a shearing machine and a shearer, in this remote part of the world. The obvious place to start making inquiries was with the Department of Agriculture, Stock and Fisheries. If any department would know of a shearing machine and a shearer within Kui, they would. And they did. Someone remembered an electric shearing machine stored in a shed somewhere. An agricultural officer, known in the lingo as a didiman, from Western Queensland, put up his hand to do the shearing. We were all set. On the appointed day and time, we assembled at Erindale. Jim had the shearing machine set up in his shed, and the sheep were dry, and yarded under cover. I can't recall how many head were shorn that day. But the job was made so much easier because, on the day, two didiman shearers turned up, instead of one. I was appointed roustabout. My job was to sweep the board, a slab of concrete in this shed, collect and skirt the fleece on a makeshift table, before baling each one. When the shearing was done, Jim Lay turned to me and said, "Hey, Piccanini Blow Mrs. Blanket, I didn't think you'd be much good working here today. You surprised me." High praise indeed, from the Lay patriarch. But my mother's dealings with Jim Lay weren't over yet. Some months after shearing, Jim put a business proposition to my mother, in an attempt to lure her away from trade and industry, and commercialize the wool project. As I recall, my mother was flattered. His inquiry was an acknowledgement of her creative thought and effort exerted to successfully introduce textile skills into the Highlands. My mother gave the proposition due consideration, but decided to decline the offer, as the freedom and perks that came with working for the New Guinea administration far outweighed the prospect of having to start all over again. After a couple of weeks of fun in the Highlands, I could hear art school calling me once more. But, before I returned to Australia, my mother floated an offbeat idea, for my consideration. Well aware of my interest in social anthropology, she suggested I think about doing a social anthropology degree at the University of Papua New Guinea, after I'd completed my art studies. I dismissed her suggestion out of hand, because I'd had more than enough of study. All I wanted to do was finish my commercial art certificate qualification, and find a job in advertising or industry. Time would tell what the future held. On reflection, Jim Lay. Patriarch Jim Lay's misassessment of my effectiveness in his shearing shed didn't surprise me. Clearly, he wasn't accustomed to a self-motivated, hard-working and efficient young white woman in the shearing shed, or anywhere else. I understand his time was taken up guiding the gaggle of nephews he'd encouraged to come to New Guinea in search of commercial opportunities, which could possibly explain his comment. Social anthropology. My mother's suggestion that I consider further study at the University of Papua New Guinea was a perceptive one. I was first exposed to aspects of anthropology when we first arrived in New Guinea, and later, archaeology and paleontology, whilst visiting my father in Africa. Yes, I was fascinated by all three sciences, but not sufficiently to commit to more years of study, even though the thought of returning to New Guinea permanently had considerable appeal. Facts. Edgar Rice Burroughs, was a prolific American writer. He wrote the Tarzan books, many of which were made into movies. I remember seeing Tarzan movies at the Saturday afternoon flicks when I was a kid. Goroka Show. Most tourists arrived by chartered aircraft, as the Highland roads were often impassable. Over the show weekend, the airstrip was lined on both sides with aircraft, parked wingtip to wingtip. DC-3s, Beechcraft, all the Cessna models, Piaggios and Twin Otters. This assortment of big and small aircraft was indicative of New Guinea's dependence on air transport for both passengers and freight.